job down at the local mill. Work dried up, not a mill is ill. I can't pay my bills. Repo man is at my door. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. Well, I had me wife, two kids, a car, and a boat. Things got bad, now the boat won't float. I don't like it. People, they used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working, we're not a working, we're just not working anymore.
Welcome to the Illinois World Hour. I'm your host, David Johnson, for the November 7th, 2009 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air on WFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, Illinois, and webcast worldwide live at www.weft.org. The views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent WEFT, its board of directors, station manager, or anyone else here at WEFT. Anyway, now here's Tom with some acknowledgments of some of our underwriters.
The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the Illinois Education Association Teachers Union and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice. Building coalitions amongst workers, unions, and the community, the Illinois Education Association and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice are proud to support WEFT Community Radio in East Central Illinois. This hour of programming is also brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that they enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. Again, I'm your host, David Johnson, here today with co-host Tom Thomas. We'll have some workers' interest news and Labor Hour cultural corner for us later in the program. Tom's poem of the week, first recited here live on Illinois World Labor Hour, is entitled Stifle the Serpent's Hiss. Also here with us today is co-host Bob Plesney, our technical expert and advisor, who has some news and banner for us as well. So now, off of the show, and some labor news headlines.
On Wednesday, the U.S. Senate voted overwhelmingly to provide the jobless of America with up to 20 weeks in additional unemployment benefits and to expand the first-time homebuyer tax credit to include a far larger pool of people entering the dormant housing market. The $24 billion bill, which passed 98 to nothing, also will provide tax relief for struggling businesses. The enactment comes to the rescue of some 2 million who will run out of benefits by the end of this year. Each person will receive 14 weeks of additional benefits, while those in states with unemployment rates of 8.5% and higher will get another 6 weeks on top of that. On Thursday, the House of Representatives decisively approved the bill calling for the extension of unemployment benefits to the around 2 million people out of work for a year and more. The national jobless rate, as of today, stands at 9.8%, but is climbing. As far as housing goes, the $8,000 tax credit for first-time homebuyers, which was enacted as part of the stimulus package in February and set to expire at the end of this month, will be extended and expanded to include a $6,500 credit for people who have lived in their current residences for at least 5 years.
Yeah, here's a late-breaking story from Philadelphia on the transit strike. A tentative contract agreement has been reached that could end the public transit strike that has idled Philadelphia's subways, buses, and trolleys for 4 days, Governor Ed Randell said late Friday. I'm very optimistic that the trains and buses will be in operation tomorrow evening, the Pennsylvania governor said late Friday night at a news conference. Randell, who has been brokering the talks, said negotiators for Transport Workers Union Local 234 and the Southeastern Pennsylvania Transportation Authority tentatively agreed on a proposed contract, and both sides are set to take a vote at 2 p.m. Saturday. We hope to be announcing the resumption of service by Saturday evening, SEPTA spokesman Richard Maloney said late Friday. The union represents about 5,000 bus drivers, subway and trolley operators, and mechanics. They walked out early Tuesday in a dispute largely centered on pension benefits. The union had threatened to strike while the World Series was in town last weekend, but negotiators continued bargaining after Randell threatened significant consequences if that happened. The union went on strike hours after the series between the Phillies and the Yankees shifted back to New York.
Bob, we couldn't have planned that better. I also have a little news segment on the Philly strike and everything. This is written by Richard Meller, who's part of Labor's Militant Voice.
Yeah.
And what he says is both the Wall Street Journal and the San Francisco Chronicle had a short, very short paragraph on the transit strike that wreaked havoc in Philadelphia Tuesday. The San Francisco Chronicle is a mass consumption newspaper, while the Wall Street Journal is a paper that the ruling class has produced for themselves. While both reports were very easy to miss due to being so brief and buried away in the depths, the difference was interesting. The Wall Street Journal had a little more detail, and the piece was slightly longer. The reader, the capital class, corporate class in the main, got a much better feel of the potential power of the workers and the effect of the stoppage. The strikers stalled the city's bus, subway, and trolley operations, the Wall Street Journal reported. It added that, quote, the sudden strike took many riders by surprise and that it all but crippled a transit system that averages more than 928,000 trips each weekday. The San Francisco Chronicle, which is meant for workers to read, opened with opinions by their so-called labor experts, saying that the striking transit workers, quote, this is quote, the striking transit workers may have a tough time earning sympathy from riders who are losing their own jobs and taking salary cuts. The Chronicle said nothing else other than that Ed Randell, Pennsylvania's Democratic governor, was, quote, stunned that the union walked out on a proposed contract that included an 11.5% wage increase over 5 years, unquote. Both papers have no interest in making struggles between bosses and workers headline news if they can avoid it. The front page of the Chronicle had a major article on great white sharks, murder, rape, acts of individual terrorism. These are newsworthy, and they are presented in such a way as to demoralize and convince us that people are inherently rotten and that this state of society is a natural as an everlasting state. Wars are good, except wars between the classes. The conclusion the Chronicle wants its working class readership to draw is that the greedy union workers are getting a great deal, but willing to disrupt people's lives, except the precious World Series. Not that a 2% or so raise every year is a big deal, given years of concessions and no doubt many more in the present contract. It attacks the transit workers for not caring about the rest of us. The Wall Street Journal's readers do not have to be convinced of this. They fear workers' unity and use the Chronicle to weaken it. Workers' unity that threatens them and their profit-making. So yeah. This was a good little thing. I would have swore we coordinated this on the phone before the show.
Somebody would think we actually talked to each other about it. Yeah, we need more news about the balloon boy.
You know? Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, that's real newsworthy, real important to most people's lives.
Hey, the housing market and stocks may be looking up somewhat, but Americans just cannot shake their job worries. And a not-too-good sign that talk of an economic recovery has yet to soothe the recession-battered nation, consumer confidence fell in October, coming in well below what analysts expected. Shopper sentiments about the state of the economy are the gloomiest in three decades, and Americans are planning to cut back big time on holiday spending. The shops and stores and markets of America have reason to worry that holiday sales will be even worse than they had feared. Of 5,000 households surveyed, half had unemployed or underemployed residents, and most said they expected even fewer available jobs in coming months. In response to the survey, 100% of the respondents said they would definitely be spending a whole lot less than usual this holiday season.
Yeah, this is a story Thursday out of Germany. Opel employees walked off their jobs to attend a mass rally at the automaker's headquarters Thursday, protesting General Motors' decision to abandon the unit sale to Magna International, which the workers had hoped would preserve their jobs. Thousands of the 25,000 employees from Opel's four German factories vented their frustration and anger at GM, which after months of negotiations decided Tuesday to scrap the sale of a majority in Opel to the Canadian auto parts maker and its Russian partner lender Sberbank. Our trust in GM is now zero, and that is the heart of the problem, Klaus Franz, the head of Opel's employee council, told thousands of workers in Rüsselsheim, winning applause. Franz called on GM to come up with a viable plan for the automaker. We are starting over again from zero, he said. GM's move has been heavily criticized by German politicians who had given strong backing to the Magna deal. The employees fear GM's decision to restructure Adam Opel GmbH on its own could result in bigger layoffs and job cuts. John Smith, GM's chief negotiator for the sale of Opel, said in a conference call Wednesday that GM's plan was similar but not identical to that presented by Magna and Sberbank, which had called for the elimination of 10,500 European jobs, or about 20% of the workforce.
Okay, well, this is from Austria, Bob. Students from all over the world, as you might have heard, all universities in Austria are currently on strike, and lecture halls are occupied by a spontaneous student movement fighting for a free and democratic education for all. This movement is currently spreading to Germany, with several lecture halls already occupied in other European countries. We, the occupants of the University of Salzburg, are calling for your solidarity and asking you to build up direct action with us. And they give an email at the email is international at unibrent-salzburg.org. And what's interesting about this is why they're going on strike, and this is students primarily, but also some of the faculty, is that unlike in the United States, the Europeans, most of the Western Europeans, consider education from preschool to the PhD level a human right, and not a luxury. And what's happening is, up until now, universities have been in Europe have been very either free or very, very cheap. And now they're trying to institute an American-style corporate model in Europe and charging higher fees and stuff. So let's spur on these workers and give them our solidarity and stuff, because they got to hold on to what they have, and then we need to start fighting back and recover all the lost ground we've lost. You know, I went to the University of Illinois back in the mid to late 1980s, and at that time, tuition was $800 a semester. And What is it now? I mean, I think it's close to $10,000 a semester. I mean,
how can I say it's at least 10 times that much now?
Yes. I mean, and you look at the regular, the inflation level, it's went way beyond that. I mean, how can a working class family send their kids to university unless they get a scholarship or a grant? And those are few and far between. Tom?
Hey, after months of roller coaster like sales, the auto industry showed signs of recovery from its year-long slump as most automakers reported higher levels of U.S. sales for October. GM, the largest U.S. automaker, reported its first monthly sales gain in almost 2 years, while Hyundai and Subaru were huge winners, thanks to their fuel-efficient sedans. Other top automakers, Toyota and Ford and Nissan, also posted higher sales rates than they have for a while. The mood was in contrast to a year ago when consumers were frightened away from showrooms by the early effects of the financial meltdown, the plunging stock market, and the credit freeze. Automakers had said this October would be a test of strength of the market after the volatile effects of the government's Cash for Clunkers program. The industry still has to see its way through a number of economic challenges, though, since Americans remain anxious about high unemployment as well as paying the bills necessary for family survival.
Okay, Dave, I got a story here out of London. A deal between postal workers and Royal Mail that ended the prospect of strikes disrupting the Christmas post aims to introduce a radically different culture of trust between the two sides, the Communication Workers Union, CWU, has said. CWU leaders agreed unanimously last night to call off a third round of strikes due to start today and postpone further action until the new year, at least while new talks take place, overseen by the arbitration service, ECAS, and Trade Union Congress, TUC. The union, which claimed Royal Mail had backed down in the face of the strikes, has stressed details of the agreement, which aims to make significant progress on further negotiations by early December, with an eventual final deal expected by the end of the year. Both Royal Mail and CWU recognize that exceptional efforts will need to be made quickly during the period of calm to rebuild trust and goodwill, the agreement says. Both parties are committed to beginning the process of restoring and improving relationships at all levels. With this in mind, it is important that there is no victimization or settling of scores arising out of the dispute. As well as seeking a long-term agreement that will successfully transform the business, the union and Royal Mail, which have long been at loggerheads over modernizing the postal service, pledged to establish a radically different culture in industrial and employee relations. Separately, the CWU claimed that much of the progress had come through the Royal Mail agreeing concessions in the face of strike threats.
Okay. Thank you, Bob.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
The state of Wisconsin is one of the first states in the country to make the teaching of labor history a mandatory part of public education. Wisconsin AFL-CIO President David Newby said it makes sense because Wisconsin has always been at the forefront of fighting for the rights of working people.
Wisconsin has been a leader in the workers' campaign for an eight-hour day starting way back in the 1880s in establishing a public education system, the first apprenticeship system in the country, first workers' compensation system in the country, one of the first family and medical leave acts back in the late 80s. We've been a leader in trying to get health care for all.
Newby said history is often made not by leaders and captains of industry, but by people, and teaching labor history in school will help make sure that story isn't overlooked.
Too often history is taught in terms of, you know, who are the great leaders, the president and the captains of industry and so forth and so on, when, you know, the real history below the surface is actually being created by working people as they organize and push for better working conditions, for a better society.
A long simmering competition over a multi-billion dollar military refueling tanker contract is heating up once again. Doug Cunningham has more.
The U.S.-based Boeing company invented the air refueling method used by U.S. military aircraft, but it's in danger of losing a $35 to $40 billion contract to a French-based company. Three Republican governors of southern states are working against Boeing's bid for this contract, which would create 44,000 good union jobs for Americans. Mississippi's Governor Haley Barbour, Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana, and Governor Bob Riley of Alabama are all supporting a group called the Aerospace Alliance to push for the French company Eads Airbus to get the work. That would create just a few thousand U.S. jobs, but the lion's share of the tens of billions of U.S. tax dollars paying for this tanker contract would flow out of this country. The Eads Airbus jobs would also pay less and have lower benefits because they would be non-union. Governor Barbour has expressed anti-union sentiment as he works to deny the American company this huge contract. He said publicly that if Eads Airbus gets the contract in his state, there would be no worries about workers being out on strike when America needs them. The International Association of Machinists is lobbying to get the contract awarded to Boeing so that the tax dollars are used to create tens of thousands of good jobs for Americans.
Okay, now we come to that portion of our program with the Illinois World Labor Hour Cultural Corner and Tom Thomas's new poem of the week, Stifle the Serpent's Hiss.
There are more people without homes than ever in our land before, and every day recession rules, we will only see more and more. The promises of stimulus so far have just not been enough, and every day the sun comes up, life for many just gets more tough. So many jobs just went away as our economy collapsed, and poor folks could not pay their rent since their salaries had elapsed. The millions of dollars daily paid to finance illegal wars are dollars that could save lives here, right here, twixt America's shores. Seeing families in the streets of America should not be the way to visualize a land where once we knew prosperity. But we still have election days, and sometimes they are even fair. Maybe our votes can fill the seats with the statesmen who belong there. Depending upon the people, democracy is hit and miss. But if enough will use our votes, we can stifle the serpent's hiss. Stifle the Serpent's Hiss was written at the Poets' Loft in Champaign, Illinois on November 4th, 2009, and was first recited live November 7th, 2009 on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. And we've got a few public service announcements here over at the Labor and Industrial Relations Institute in the U of I campus on Saturday, November 14th. They'll be having a class, Union Democracy, Rights in Your Union. It's from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., and it's at 504 East Armory. It's a one-day seminar for elected officers who want to increase the power of their union through democratic participation and for rank-and-file members who want to learn how to exercise democratic rights in their union. Detroit attorney Barbara Harvey, who has worked on union democracy issues for 30 years, and Richard Gerba, compliance officer from the Department of Labor, will present. And also coming up at the Labor Institute on November 30th to December 4th, another class, Preparing and Presenting Arbitration Cases. This is the IBEW 6th District Arbitration Institute coming to the University of Illinois Labor Education Center, and one discharge case and one contract interpretation case will be included in this class. And last but not least, December 4th through the 6th in Chicago is the National Convention for U.S. Labor Against the War. And if you need any more information about any of these events and courses, you can call 217-333-0980. Okay. Now,
yeah, Dave,
yes.
I did want to mention that we're in the middle of our fall membership drive.
Yes.
And you can call us at 217-359-9338 and pledge your support. No pledge is too small or none too large. Or you can go online at weft.org, and you can click on the blue Donate Now link, and we'll take any amount of money. That would be most appreciated.
Yes, because you will not have any kind of labor program on a corporate radio station.
That's
or TV
for sure.
Station.
That's
and
for sure.
This is the special thing about WFT, is not just our public affairs programs, but also the music we play, the various
right.
music shows. Again, gets no airplay on corporate stations. I mean, how many corporate stations out there have reggae music right. or even blues music, for that matter? And you're never going to hear the Pirates on late Friday night.
No.
That's for sure. Anyway, and what's the name of that show? It's Pirate's Life for Me.
Pirate's Life for Me.
Those guys are just outrageous. And,
they are.
You know, something a little different, that's for sure. We're going to play a song from Ann Feeney, Punching In, and then we're going to get right to our guests here that have agreed to come in all the way from Effingham today.
Hip 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 hip, way to do, way to do, hip 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 hip, way to do, way to do, hip 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 hip, boom 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 boom, sha na na na. Doobie doobie
down, doobie doo down down. My computer's down, doobie doo down down. My computer's down, doobie doo down down. And punch it in is all we do. Right from the day we got those VDTs, my life has been so full of misery. No one knows what we've been through. And punch it in is all we do.
Okay, that was Ann Feeney and Punching In. And now we want to introduce our special guest that drove all the way from Effingham here today. Could you, ladies, could you introduce yourselves?
My name is Azure Newman.
Okay.
And I'm Anna Beck.
Okay, and why are you here? First of all, and you are?
Heartland, and we were the Heartland Strikers.
Okay, all right, and that's Heartland. Can you explain a little bit about Heartland? What is it that they do?
Heartland is the mental health system in Effingham County.
Okay.
And I'm a counselor case manager there.
Okay.
And I've been there 8 years.
Okay. Yes, now I heard that this is the strike lockout you were involved in that just ended not too long ago. It was one of the longest in recent Illinois history?
Yes, it was. It lasted, what, 26 months? 26 months, pretty much, from the day we walked out to the day we walked back in on September 2nd.
Okay. Now, how did this all begin?
This started back in August of 2005 with a meeting that the executive director called in the basement. It was an all-staff meeting. At this meeting, she informed us that she was going to be cutting our paid time off benefits. They were changing the way that they were going to do it. She was cutting three of our holidays, and she was intending on instituting something called productivity.
Oh, that's always productivity and team. Those are the two words you got to fear there.
Yes. And in the mental health field, which is where both Anna and I work, there's a subjective element to it. And if your client doesn't show up because, you know, if he was in, you know, used alcohol or whatever and was hungover and didn't want to come to his appointment, or, you know, with mental health, if their illness was preventing them from getting there, you, the counselor, were being penalized for that because they were not only instituting this, they were using it for, it was nice if they were using it for bonuses, but they were also using it as a consequence. And if you were below that level, you were subject to discipline, reprimand, and eventually termination.
Oh, that's ridiculous. I mean, what are you supposed to do? Go and round the person up at their home or go look for them in a nearby bar or something? I mean,
I actually did the productivity.
Uh-huh.
And it was really hard to do because I do the community the program. They call it CIS. It's all the community people that come that have long-term mental illness. And then they have residential clients that also are there all the time for programs. So many times everything gets all mixed up. You may have a schedule, but your schedule may not ever materialize. They also have us answering crisis calls at the hospital and the jail during the day. So if we have someone scheduled and they want to call us out to go to the jail, then we just drop what we're doing and we go to the jail and do their crisis for them or the hospital, which may take anywhere from an hour to 2 to 3 hours.
Yeah, that'd be kind of, how do you factor that into the whole productivity thing? I mean,
there,
you know,
anyway,
like you're on an assembly line, you know, assembling widgets or whatever. Now, this has been going, okay, so that happened, and then you guys decided that you thought you should form a union. When did that happen?
This is what you're going to have to.
Well, actually, our president.
Hold on one moment, please. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, David. This is Gail.
Okay, Gail. Great. Listeners, I want to let you know that this is Gail Warner, and she was a third co-worker here from Heartland, and we thought it'd be kind of cool to have her call in as well as have our two live guests in the studio. So anyway, can you hear everyone here, Gail?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I can hear you so far.
Okay. Very good. Then we'll continue on with what you were saying.
Well, I think Gail probably could answer this better than I can, so
okay.
Ask her the question.
Okay, I guess the question was that when did, we're told about the productivity grand idea that the management came up with, and then my question was when did the workers decide they wanted to form a union?
Oh, my. We've lived a lifetime since then, it seems like.
Uh-huh.
I think that, in the fall of 2005, when they took away a lot of our benefits and everything, and then that's when they really started hammering home that, percent of clients you had to see face-to-face. It was just almost impossible for people because, I'm sure you've discussed, in a mental health facility, you have to rely on people, and they're not reliable. You know, with your substance abusers, sometimes they didn't have, the license to be able to travel to work, and they depended on someone else. So you're depending on two or three different entities or people, to be able to see those clients face-to-face, and just the productivity was just impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And management just did not go by common sense there. They couldn't understand that, it's not your fault if people don't show for their appointments. We weren't dealing with something reliable or predictable. you know, in that mm-hmm, case. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was a few, you know, it was probably about a year before we decided to sign, you know, the union card, that the productivity was always there. It was just at that point they knew there was no getting around it.
Okay.
And we just had to do something. So
yeah, now, before the show, I was talking to both of you, and you said that this actually started in someone's basement.
It was Heartland's basement.
Oh, yeah. So it was on the job site. Well, that's even more inspiring. Okay.
Yeah, we were dragged down to the basement for a mandatory meeting, and we all had to be there. And we found out a year or so later, while we were out on the picket line, that she actually had some, you know, police officers out there because she knew this was going to infuriate her employees, and she really. That's what started the whole thing, is that our director had no regard for our feelings whatsoever. I mean, she knew, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that it was going to cause an uproar, but she just did not care.
She
didn't care
in.
About giving us respect or a voice in the workplace. She said she did, you know, the open door policy and all that stuff, but
okay.
When it really came down to brass tacks, she did not care what we thought.
And yes, Anna, you were saying?
She walked into the meeting and announced that there would be no questions, there would be no discussion. That this is how it was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
That was her approach.
Gail, can you hear Anna?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Okay.
And they also had a board member there who happened to be a preacher at one of the local churches.
Okay.
He was the president of our board throughout this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, they had the meeting. They said you could respond online or email back to them, and they would answer questions.
And we had plenty of questions presented to them, which I still have copies of those. You know, you hold on to things that really mean something, and none of them were ever answered. You know, I went back through them, you know, over the years, and they were never answered. You know, it was just always sidestepping the real issues.
Okay.
So
what happened next then?
Then we started negotiation. Well, actually, we voted in the union, and it was almost unanimous. Only like 5 people out of the whole facility did not vote for the union.
How many people was this total?
Well, what was our total back then?
Was it about 52 or 3, something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, something
okay.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so once we voted it in, then we started negotiations a few months later. And right off the bat in negotiations, it was so frustrating. This woman would walk in with her attorney, and very few of the board members ever attended throughout all of the time frame. And she would just sit there and look at us, and everything we approached them with or presented to them, well, we'll stay on our first proposal. We refer back to our first proposal, which was actually the first proposal that was ever given to us.
And that's what we ended up getting, yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what we ended up with 2 years
later.
It was
all for nothing.
Was what the first proposal was, just like a little bit off of what was actually the first two proposals, ours and theirs, combined. With some, you know, a few differences in them, but that's what we ended up with 2 years later. After this woman's gone, I mean, she was terminated in all of this.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, we think she was terminated. They never really
still
came
hasn't
out
been replaced
saying,
either.
Yeah.
Well, she definitely. I was sitting out on the strike line that day. Two board members went in. She came out alone and left in the middle of the afternoon. We know they gave her 3 months of severance pay now.
Okay.
So she definitely was terminated.
Okay, all right.
But they never verified.
Okay, how long did these negotiations go on until you guys basically got went on strike, got locked out?
Let's see. They started in what, March of 06, and we voted to strike we went on strike on July 2nd, 2007, so about what, 15, 16 months?
Yes.
Oh my gosh. 15, 16 months of negotiations, not getting anywhere.
But yeah. They would only negotiate maybe once a month.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was always just we reaffirm our original position. That's all they ever said.
And this
said,
was like
really.
A broken record then, pretty much.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much.
So frustrating. Beating your head up against a wall.
Okay.
is what it is like.
And also, throughout this time, they would cancel many scheduled negotiations.
Uh-huh.
And then they would stagger them, and it might be 2 months between negotiations. We filed at least 22 unfair labor practices. Not one unfair labor practice was found legitimate, even though in the past these were all bona fide labor practice disputes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and we attended so many, you know, different meetings out of our region, you know, like we'd go to Chicago or we'd go to certain conferences, and the National Labor Relations Board attorneys would tell us, you know, these are slam dunks, these are no brainers.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you not win these? And, you know, we still to this day have no idea. It was just so frustrating, you know.
We had to send them all.
That's why we fought so hard for the Employee Free Choice Act. You know, we traveled everywhere doing speeches and trying to get that passed, because had that been in place, and if it was in place now, you know, how much easier would it be for people, you know?
Yeah, and this, you know, this
have to go through this.
I've heard this scenario before as far as the stalling also this whole thing with the basically making companies abide by the law. I mean, there's definitely an enforcement problem, it seems like. And it almost seems like they know that it seems like it's more profitable for them to take you know, do things they know they're going to get hit with unfair labor practice charges, but there doesn't seem to be much teeth in the law, nor any very much enforcement. That's what it seems to me, anyway. I've seen this happen in the past. It seems like this is what happened to you as well.
Well, we were in the background working this whole time that we were on strike.
Mm-hmm.
We were out in the community trying to get community support, but we're in an area that is very non-union.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were out putting signs up, getting permission to put signs up. We had people sign petitions for us. We were getting clients that had had any interaction with this facility to make out statements, and we sent those to DHS in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
hoping to get some kind of support through the state, because they're funded. 98% of their funding came through the state.
Oh, really?
It's a private
98%. Okay.
Private non-practice entity,
uh-huh.
nonprofit. And we really have some serious problems there, everybody. Mm-hmm. We've got to stop this private non-practice. Private non-profit that's getting everything in such jumble, because there were so many loopholes, so many things that came up with us that we would find out that there was no one to answer. They didn't have to answer to anyone.
Mm-hmm. They're insulated by their supporters, basically.
And
no getting past it.
We kept saying, "Well, who answers to who? Who does the executive board? I mean, who does the board answer to? Who does the board answer to at a private nonprofit? Everyone should find out, because we found out no one." So finally, the ultimate steps that we're taking, we went to the governor's office.
Mm-hmm.
We kept pounding the governor's office.
This was in Rob Blagojevich was governor?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's right during the time, actually, it happened. It happened right in the middle of when we were actually trying to push for it, and we ended up with our new governor, you know, and it was...
You approached it just when the FBI arrested him?
Pretty close.
Pat Quinn was scheduled to speak at our Christmas dinner
last
year. He was coming to see us.
And the day before was when he was sworn in as governor.
Well, how interesting, because you know what? We've talked about what happened up in Chicago with the Republic Windows and Doors occupation. You know, the third day into the occupation, Blagojevich makes a big public news conference and says about how he's going to pull support from Bank of America with the state of Illinois monies. And the very next day, he gets arrested, and supposedly the FBI had been building a case for 2 years. And, you know, us with our conspiracy minds, which has basically been proven to be right most of the time in the past, he gets arrested the next day he does it. Now we find out he was coming to see you guys in Effingham as well.
No, Pat Quinn.
Oh, Pat Quinn was, but still under the Blagojevich administration.
Right.
Yeah. And let me tell you something about Pat Quinn, a man of character. I'll tell you. You know, he did go ahead and call during our Christmas party and gave us full support. You know, he was so just, his candor was so awesome. His character was great. And then a year later, we marched on the Capitol, you know, when they cut all the funds for mental health, and he remembered us. I mean, now that is a man of character.
Well, that's unusual in this day and age.
Yeah, and it was refreshing after Blagojevich, let me tell you.
We had Rich Trubka came down and walked the picket line with us.
He was awesome.
Absolutely wonderful. He went in and sat down with us at our local headquarters, and we all talked to him individually, one-on-one.
Yeah.
And we have pictures with him standing with his arm around us, strikers, because he's supporting us. It was absolutely the most... It was just awesome. And these are the type of things that kept us going. Everyone always wants to know, bottom line, how did you guys pull this off
after all that
time?
Yes.
And they, believe me, they were doing everything. They were pounding every direction trying to break us. And we couldn't get any help from our local newspapers. Every time we would talk them into doing a story, they twisted it around so it was in the favor of the of the employer.
You know, that's. I'm glad you brought that up because it's going to be my next question here. Is that you know, during the course of this, you know, we get information, bits and pieces of it, and that was one thing we heard about a call to action. It was all over our local emails and stuff, our local listservs, about wanting needing volunteers from this Champaign-Urbana to go down to Effingham to go and directly leaflet citizens there because the local newspapers were refusing to give you any coverage or unbiased coverage, at least. When they did give you coverage, it was always slanted towards the private nonprofit company. Mm-hmm.
And we did have people come and go out and do the leaflets. It poured down the rain that day.
Yeah, Jobs with Justice were implemental in that. They were great.
Okay, and how did the residents of Effingham respond to this?
Well, door to door, they responded great. Uh-huh. I mean, people even gave us cash. They're like, here, put this in your coffers to keep you going, you know.
Well, that's excellent.
It was amazing. And they let us put signs in their yards, and we had support. It was just, you know, they wanted to speak out and put their name down. Now, they didn't really quite want to do that.
Okay.
We had so much, like, behind-the-scenes support.
Okay. Well, it sounds like your community is a lot like ours and probably hundreds of thousands around the country where their local newspaper or media doesn't reflect the views, the real views of the citizens.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But this
they
is,
pick and choose what's news.
And it seems it's always in favor of the corporate interest. But I think this was a great strategy to totally in-run the local rag, if you will, newspaper.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we had an inside connection to the newspaper.
Yes.
So anything that went down was immediately leaked.
okay. Well, that's inspiring. You were in charge of intelligence, counterintelligence. Okay.
We definitely had a lot of strategies going on. Mm-hmm. We were completely, that's what we did out on that strike line. You put a bunch of women together and you're going to come up with strategy, I guarantee it.
But, all labor history's full of those stories.
Yeah, well, this is a good one too. But we actually, people would walk by on the sidewalk and they give us, and then they drive by. That last few weeks we were out there, we were really pushing for the horn honking. We had so many people going by and honking their horns that the people inside, we were hearing rumors that they were wondering what was going on.
That's and excellent.
They had to have been wondering at that point just where they stood in the scabs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can say that word on the air here.
Well, we're working with some
we're
of them, you
know. Working with some of them now, so it's kind of a...
Yeah.
Okay.
And so... That is a whole story to itself, is the scabs.
Uh-huh.
We walked back in, and they were like, they just took my job. That's what they told, one of them told my daughter. We just took her job. I was like, that wasn't her job to start with.
Well, indeed. Oh, man. You know, we had Mike Griffin on the show a couple weeks ago from this Daily Struggle. Don't get him started on scabs. I mean, in fact, Ann Feeney's got a song, The Lowest Life Form That's Ever You Had. Yes.
I used to park my car out on the strike line and crank that
up. We sang that a lot.
Yeah, that was
Ann Feeney was amazing. Yeah, she was a great encouragement.
Well, yes, when did she come down, by the way, to perform?
She's been down here several times. Yeah, she did a great job.
She did a concert. Was it back in April, I think?
Okay.
She came down and performed for a group of us, yeah.
Okay.
And at every conference we ever went to, she would be one of the performers, and she was just one of those people that just always gave you that extra spirit and that extra push to keep going. I mean, and she still emails me to this day. She's
she
an amazing, phenomenal woman.
Too.
She never gives up.
Well, that's excellent. We're going to take just a short little musical break here. Gail, if you could stay in the line.
Okay.
I just got to play this Ann Feeney song here, and we'll be right back.
All right.
There's an alien life form been creeping round my job site. Oh, they look almost human, but something about them ain't right. They cross right over a picket line. Pay no attention to a picket sign. They're called scabs, scabs. The lowest life form spawned in nature's lab rings. They got no heart. Scabs are tearing our communities apart. They might be reptilian. The blood flows like ice in their veins. Or extraterrestrial.
Okay, that was Ann Feeney doing her classic song, Scabs. I just had to play that. Okay, well, getting back here, you know what really surprises me, too, or maybe I should say it doesn't surprise me. You've seen all sorts of weird corporate government collusion these days. But how the heck they were able to get away with this, considering they had other funds came from the state? I mean,
well, back in late October of 2007, we received word, and it actually made the front page of the local newspaper, that the state had cut their funds by what, 2/3?
It was a third.
Okay, I knew it was something like that. It was a fraction of it. They cut it there in October of 2007, and so of course management's response to that was to file an injunction against.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we had to go to court.
but that kind of turned back on them. Yeah, the headline read Heartland was granted the injunction, but what that injunction did was it allowed us. We had been sitting in a tent in the ditch outside of Heartland, and they were complaining that they couldn't see traffic going each way, and that could be a hazard. So we got permission to put a temporary shelter on Heartland's property.
We got into their yard.
Wow. We were in their yard.
That's so began all of the vandalism, and we ended up with a really nice shed. We just every time they would tear it down, kick it in, write on it, put racial slurs or any kind of slurs on it, we would just get a bigger and better one. It was amazing.
Oh wow! So that was part of this campaign too. Some thuggery, huh?
Oh yeah. Yes, we definitely had.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They vandalized everything we put up, but we just every time it just gave us more resolve that we were going to be bigger and better and last even longer.
And, we had a mediator in with us on this too from the day we went on strike. He was there the day we went on strike. A mediator had been with us, and he was with us throughout the next 2 years also in all of our negotiations. And this mediator, we had negotiations one day, and he was taking stock of how we responded to the negotiations. And I said, all they've done today is just make me more determined that they're not going to do this anymore to us.
Oh, good, good. That's so important. I mean, keep that fighting spirit going. And I know it's got to get hard. I mean, between the boredom and the day after day of where is this ever going to end?
Yeah. Plus, it's all women. You ever put that many women together? We got like 30 of us.
Well, I've seen some fantastic stuff with combinations of women in groups like that. So don't don't sell yourself short here. So.
But getting back to the question of how this continued to go, we didn't really hear anything back from the state until we heard in, was it this late spring of this year,
mm-hmm.
that the executive director and the president of the board got called up to a meeting at the governor's office, and the governor, and by then it was Quinn,
mm-hmm.
told them to settle this or he was going to pull their funding. They knew in May, I think, of this year that there was a possibility that it was going to happen. And then, of course, the budget crisis came and everybody was sort of lobbying. And I remember in June, the front page of the Effingham paper had a thing about another local, the Developmentally Disabled Facility, ARC, they were having protests and they were marching and they were wanting their funding. And they were doing all of this stuff. And there was a headline below saying, Heartland will be affected by this too. That's when they had found out that they had gotten the letter from the state saying that as of July 1st, they would no longer be, their contracts were being canceled.
Mm, mm-hmm.
And yet she wasn't protesting, she wasn't doing anything until the July 2nd. It was our two-year anniversary, and the paper came out, and there suddenly she was. She was outraged. She thought that the community should be outraged and up in arms and mad at us for this happening.
Yeah, and she didn't even go to the Capitol. We did. She did.
Yeah, we went to the Capitol. Right. We didn't see her there.
To keep the funds.
Uh-huh. Right. Okay.
But they also, we're talking about the executive person here.
Mm-hmm.
We're not
mm-hmm.
talking about the board or anyone else. She was the target on all of this because she seemed to be running everything, even though they'll tell you the board did it.
Mm-hmm.
But she definitely was the one running everything. And it was funny in the paper. She was outraged over what had just taken place with the funding cuts. And she even pointed out in the paper, because we kept telling everyone, this isn't the same thing as what's going on with the budget cuts. She has lost all funding. Everyone just kept associating it with the budget cuts, but
mm-hmm.
we wanted them to know, and they were literally going to close their doors.
I don't understand why, considering all these problems and everything, why the state of Illinois, even like you alluded to earlier, just get rid of this whole intermediary with these private nonprofit companies and just have you directly work for the state of Illinois.
We would have loved that.
Yeah.
We would have loved for a state to come in and take over. Yeah, that
yeah.
would have been it would be security for our community.
Mm-hmm.
This should not ever have happened to our community. These are citizens of the community, just like us. They live out there with us all around. I see people every day that are struggling over the same things that I'm struggling over, and yet they have to come into my office and work through me to try to maintain. And that structure was taken from them, And she did get everything up and running, but it was with people with no experience whatsoever,
mm-hmm.
people that actually she wouldn't have hired in the past for mm-hmm. any reason.
Mm-hmm.
And now we've went back in there, and everything was a total chaotic mess.
I bet.
We have spent, since the day we walked back in, trying to get the files back in form. They had stacks of filing that's never been done. So we're repeating a lot of that paperwork that's due, and it has to be in there to meet requirements, because nobody's willing to tackle that stack yet, or there's several
but yet,
of them.
But yet, the scabs were, you know, heralded as heroes.
In the paper.
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
In letters to the editor by the board members.
Oh, yes. Well,
they were heroes. They kept our jobs in place. Ooh, they were heroes.
Yeah. Well, you know, not only is, I think, this sort of system, this private nonprofit companies doing these services that should be done directly by the state of Illinois. I mean, really, you'd think that this is going to, well, you know that this is going to this costs the state more money than hiring you guys, directly, because this private nonprofit wants to make a profit, even though they're called nonprofit.
Right.
If nothing else, I know how this scam works. If nothing else, the board pays themselves salaries and bonuses, you know, out the yin yang, if you will.
Our executive director was making at least $100,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
I had worked there 5 years and had never made a dollar more an hour than when I hired in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she made five times more than the lowest paid person.
I walked in there with a bachelor's degree
mm-hmm.
and experience.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I could never reach $10 an hour.
Wow. You know, and not only was this whole system cost the taxpayers more in terms of money, but also, as you talked about earlier, disrupting services for the citizens that this facility serves. So, I mean, there's two good reasons why, the state of Illinois should actually own and operate these facilities directly. It'd be better for the workers, better for the community, better for the taxpayers, you know. So why isn't that? I mean, why is this, there's this fetish, if you will, obsession with privatization? You know, it's got to be privatized because supposedly it's more efficient, even if it's a quote-unquote nonprofit entity, you know. That's a question
well,
I'm kind of throwing out there.
This town, David, this town's mentality is, unions are bad, in a sense, because they protect the lazy workers. And I'll tell you one thing, not one woman out there on that picket line could ever be perceived as lazy.
Well, of course.
My God.
Yes.
I mean, come on. we spent every day, not only were we keeping our families together, we were out there every day. And, you know, and there wasn't a moment I didn't think about, you know, what could we do? I mean, we brainstormed 24/7, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was exhausting.
Oh, I can imagine.
And, you know, if we didn't prove that we were, you know, good workers by what we went through, I mean, I don't know what could prove that.
I mean, you man those picket lines through the bitter cold of winter, through the
yeah,
heat and humidity of the summer.
That first summer was brutal.
And anyone listening outside of Central Illinois, we get both extremes.
Yes, we do.
Extreme cold wind chill and the stifling heat and humidity, you know. So
and the bulk of the last year, there were 15 of us manning the strike lines.
Wow.
Yeah. And until we got the really nice accommodations with the new wooden shed that we got, it was downright cold. We're out there existing under a canopy, you know, with no wind block until we decided to get some, you know.
We got shower curtains.
Shower curtains.
Yeah.
Because they had to see through them
because we were a vision
problem, yeah.
Wow, this is just such an incredible story. And what would you like to? What are some ending words here about advice to other workers that went through, or that may go through what you went through in the future?
Well, my first and only thing I kept saying through the whole thing was, once we walked out the door, quitting was not an option.
Mm-hmm.
It was never an option. When everyone would get at their weakest point, you can hear me. They were ready to strangle me. I'd stand up and I'd say, "Quitting's not an option." So that's the first step. When you take that step, you take
mm-hmm.
that step knowing that you've made a choice. You're going to stand by your choice. And no matter how rough it gets and how low you get, that quitting is not an option.
Well, that's great. You know, you guys, girls, women, I should say, are real heroes and you're real inspiration and everything. And I just want to thank you so much for driving an hour and a half up here today to come live and stew. And Gail, thank you so much for calling in. I thought that worked out pretty good with you two live and Gail on the phone and everything. So we're going to end here with a little Ann Feeney song, We Do the Work, and we will be right back. We'll be right back. Okay, that was Ann Feeney. We do the work. And one thing, I want to again thank the Heartland workers for driving all the way up here from Effingham today. And it's a very inspiring story. And just as they were leaving the studio during our music break, they mentioned that Helena Worthing, who is the wife of Joe Barry, who both are professors at the Labor and Industrial Relations Institute of the U of I, are going to be writing a book about the struggle of the Heartland workers. So we'll keep you posted on that. Coming up here. And anyway, I want to make one last pitch here. Please call in and give your support to WFT Radio. This is your radio station, listener supported, and you'll never hear programs like the Illinois World Labor Hour, News from Neptune, or any other public affairs program, nor will you hear the variety of music like even the show following us here, Close to the Fire. I mean, that type of music is rarely heard on corporate stations. So, you know, if you want a diverse, true free speech radio station, please call in and pledge any amount that you can. And now we will go to Close to the Fire. Thank you for tuning in.